Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring the Community Water Center's leaders as recipients of the 2018 James Irvine Foundation's Leadership Awards, on the web at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment, health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we talk with the author of a new biography on the life of Fresno's Kurt Kerkorian. We'll learn how his early life in the Valley helped shape his career as a billionaire dealmaker who conquered Hollywood, Las Vegas, and the auto industry. We'll also get an update on the high-speed rail project's new business plan. Now that costs have gone up again and the timeline has been pushed back, what does it mean for the troubled project? And a look at a new bill in Sacramento that would ban willful defiance suspensions in California schools. And a preview of our Wednesday night event at Valley Public Radio's Broadcast Center about air quality. It's a Be Public Live forum, and you're invited to attend. Our own Carrie Klein will join us today to talk about what's on deck and to recap this winter's pollution season. We'll find out how many days this past winter that Valley County's topped pollution charts. We begin, though, in Tulare County. California has some of the highest reaching goals in the nation when it comes to reducing carbon emissions. Our state is also where some of the most innovative clean technology is developed and manufactured. Valley Public Radio's Laura Tsutsui reports on how an electric bus company is coming to California and is already changing transit in one Central Valley town.
When you think of electric vehicles, you probably think of Tesla, Silicon Valley, and automakers in Southern California like Toyota. It's likely that you aren't thinking of Porterville, a small city near the foothills of Tulare County, but that could change.
As you enter, it's bright and white and clean.
Is it on right now?
It is on.
Richard Tree is the transit manager for the city of Porterville. Last week, we took a ride on the first of 10 electric buses purchased by the city.
Let's get this bad boy up to a Mach 3.
With the help of a grant from the California Air Resources Board, Porterville bought 10 electric buses from Canadian startup Green Power Motor Company. These battery-powered buses will replace nearly half of their fleet, and they're one of the first Valley cities to make such a dramatic switch. At the same time, Green Power is building its first North American assembly plant in Porterville.
My feeling is that Porterville has won the lottery of one being awarded $9.5 million to buy transit buses, but we won the lottery with Green Power choosing Porterville.
Brendan Riley is the president of Green Power.
We just made our first public transit delivery just yesterday, and you were on it.
Up until now, Green Power has been selling buses as shuttles for tourist companies and airports. Green Power isn't the first electric bus company to move to the state, but it is the first to settle in the Valley.
The reason we chose Porterville is that it's located in the San Joaquin Valley, the place that needs this technology more than anything else. So we just saw it as really just a convergence of need for our product, a great location to build, and a partner in a local transit property that was sophisticated enough to deal with this technology and help incorporate it and work collaboratively with us.
The plant isn't built yet. The buses Porterville has were actually built at a contract factory in China. Riley hopes more nearby transit agencies take the leap and adopt electric buses. The transition, though, can be hard. Porterville officials say they'll have to train bus operators on how to efficiently drive an electric one. John Drayton is the former director of vehicle technology for LA Metro. He wrote the plans to transition the agency's fleet to zero-emission vehicles, including electric ones. While LA Metro has always been an early adopter of clean, new technology, Drayton can attest to the growing pains.
And you'd always have a couple old line mechanics that said, I'm never going to touch one of those things. Are you out of your mind? You know, they'd self-select and say, I'm not going to deal with natural gas and new technology. We saw the same thing with battery electric buses. We had operators that refused to drive them. We had mechanics that said they're not going to touch them. You know, just the personnel issues going to new technology are significant.
Now as a consultant, Drayton is helping other transit agencies make the switch to cleaner technology. But he says that doesn't always mean electric.
the battery bus that's available today is not a perfect replacement for your standard transit bus. Natural gas continues to be a great option and a great alternative. So it's not like there's a perfect single solution out there that's going to fit everybody. That may come down the road. We may see something in the mid-2020s.
Whether electric is the best option or not, the California Air Resources Board may soon decide that electric buses are the only option, at least when it comes to replacing old diesel or natural gas buses. Dean Flores is a member of the California Air Resources Board and a former state senator from Kern County.
Well, I think you need to mandate the fact that when you have an opportunity to retire either a diesel bus or a CNG bus, that it's just got to be an electric bus. And I think with that comes some incentives from our cap and trade program to allow people to move into that new environment.
Right now, the Air Resources Board is working on the Innovative Clean Transit Rule, which has a goal to achieve zero emission transit by 2040. Flores hopes that this is the first step to getting other diesel-reliant industries to adopt cleaner technology, too.
One of the biggest things that buses will do, if we can get this done, is then it then transforms other industries, heavy-duty industries like school buses. So it isn't just about transit. I think in some sense, you know, it's about being a leader in this entire large kind of machinery field with electrification.
In Porterville, Richard Tree is more than happy to be a leader.
We took the risk of jumping in first, but it's paying off the benefits as an agency that struggles to find funding. So we're not stopping there. 10 was, you know, it's great, but we've made a commitment to be 100% zero emission fleet-wide.
He plans to introduce the electric buses to city streets as early as next month. Green Power hopes to be assembling buses by the end of this year. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui in Porterville.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The new biography of billionaire investor Kirk Kerkorian tells the story of how a young boy from Fresno went on to become one of the richest businessmen in America. From airlines to film studios to the auto industry, Kerkorian was the consummate dealmaker, but he was also a quiet philanthropist supporting Armenian causes through his Lindsay Foundation. Joining us now to tell us more is journalist William C. Rempel, author of the new book, The Gambler: How Penniless Dropout Kirk Kerkorian Became the Greatest Dealmaker in Capitalist History. William, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's easy to say Kirk Kerkorian's life was a Horatio Alger story. Perhaps should we update that now and say these types of stories are Kirk Kerkorian stories?
Well, that would be appropriate, just exactly. He sort of set the mold here.
Now, Kerkorian was famously private about his life for the most part throughout his career. How did you come to write this book, and what sort of access did you get to Kerkorian's family, his stories along those lines?
Well, you know, I didn't know Kirk Kerkorian personally. I didn't know very much about him at all, as a matter of fact. But when he died in 2015 at the age of 98, an editor at HarperCollins, the publishing house, read his obituary in the New York Times and was just struck by what an incredible life he lived, and yet she'd never heard about him. So she called me to see if I would take a look. And, of course, I didn't know much about him either, so I started looking into what I could find, and it was what I could see was incredible. He had such a colorful life and a long and a rich one. But I actually thought that he and I may have had the same father, in a sense, that both of our fathers were farmers in Fresno area, and Kirk's father was also, like mine, an entrepreneur and had some financial bad luck, and so Kirk grew up experiencing a lot of financial uncertainty. They moved a lot after they left Fresno. They moved to L.A. And he was often the new kid in school and had all this uncertainty, which was very similar to mine. But and he became a billionaire and I did not.
Such are the quirks of history and fate. You mentioned his father and growing up in Fresno. They encountered great financial difficulties while they were here. Tell me a little more about that and how that early experience shaped Kirk's life.
Sure. His father arrived from Armenia in the early part of the century and immediately began gathering up farm properties. And at one point had held the deeds for about $1 million worth of property and vineyards and orchards and such, but it was all heavily leveraged with debt. And in the early 1920s, the recession of the 1920s hit, and he was wiped out. So by that time they were living in had a ranch near Bakersfield, and that ranch was foreclosed upon, and Kirk and the family were evicted.
And what happens to them from there in his teens and young adulthood? How did Kirk's story begin to set him on the path to fortune?
Well, one of the things he learned, I think, traces to that austere beginning, was that to put value in your family and your friends, the things you could count on, and not put value in things which are come and go. And so he became a very loyal and devoted member of his member of the family, and he would do anything he could to make money to help the family. He worked as a teenager. He worked on the CCC up in Sequoia, digging ditches and building trails and brush removal and all that sort of thing. Just heavy, hard work. And then he got into amateur boxing, and he boxed in all up and down the San Joaquin Valley on amateur fights, and got his nickname there, Rifle Right Kerkorian. I guess he had a pretty wicked right hand hook, and so that he was a very competitive fellow, and at a young age, and he loved to fight, he loved to box. And he had a great capacity for hard work and hard training.
Your book is called The Gambler, and certainly referencing not only his involvement in Las Vegas casinos, but his ability to make sometimes very risky bets. Most of the time, they seem to play out for him. In some cases, they didn't. Could this not also be called the deal maker? Just given his affinity for constantly turning properties, he went through MGM, what, three times?
Yes.
What did he look for in a deal from the people that you spoke with who knew him? What was his approach to these types of ventures?
Well, he was looking for what he called the hidden value. In the case of MGM, when he first purchased MGM, it was when the movie studio was in terrific financial trouble in the late 60s. And Kirk realized that it held a lot of really valuable real estate that was being used by an obsolete back lot. And he realized the value of its movie library even years before the cable industry turned those movies into valuable assets. But he knew it was. So anyway, he was looking for that sort of thing, hidden value.
Were there specific investments that maybe didn't pay off in his career that he looked back on with regret?
Well, I don't know about the regret. I know that he was not a gambler who regretted his losses. He loved gambling. He said the greatest thrill in life was to win a big bet, and the second greatest thrill was to lose a big bet. The thrill of the risk was something he savored, and so we probably wouldn't be able to find things he regretted in the investment standpoint. But you know, one of the last big investments that he made was in Las Vegas, was the City Center project. It was enormously expensive, and it was built in the teeth of the into the teeth of the 2008-09 recession. He lost during that period in the recession, and with the City Center project, he probably lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $15 billion. I mean, half of his net worth, and still he was a billionaire. But he never expressed regret about it. He just, in fact, there are times when he said he would wouldn't it be fun to start over again, just lose it all and get to build this again?
How did he get involved in Las Vegas to begin with? Before Kerkorian, Vegas was controlled by the Bugsy Siegels of the world and the mob. Kerkorian came in, and how did he get entry into there, and why Vegas? There were so many other business opportunities.
Well, yeah, you know, part of it was his love of gambling. It went back to the days when he operated a charter airline, that's a little small airline that just mostly took gamblers to Las Vegas from Los Angeles right after the war. And so he was in Vegas a lot, and he discovered he loved the craps tables and some of the and 21 and all those things. And he at some point he actually tried to invest in the Dunes operation and lost his first $50,000 of investment money, but he had the bug and realized that he wanted to own the house, not be the gambler losing to the house, and that was part of his drive. And his first investment, when he made his first million off of his charter airline, he turned around with that million and pretty much put it all into a piece of property on the strip that was just a vacant piece of sand. It turned out to be prime property where they built the Caesar's Palace. And he was the landlord for Caesar's Palace for a few years. And that's where he really, really turned things around financially for himself. And it was one of the best real estate investments in the history of Las Vegas.
How did he fit in with other billionaire celebrities, billionaire investors, or you know, even those who were maybe not quite as rich, but certainly as famous or more so? Was he in that circle, or was he an outsider?
Well, he did not run with other billionaires. No, he was in that sense an outsider. But his interest was so varied. He was invested in airlines and movie studios and casinos and hotels. He later got into the automobile industry with major investments in all three of the big three. And so he was very different from say a dot-com kind of investor who strikes it rich. So he had a different background, a different interest, and it was eclectic as could be.
When you look at his portfolio, casinos, real estate, hotels, one immediately thinks about another deal maker, a self-proclaimed deal maker, in that being our current president, Donald Trump. Did they have a relationship, number one? And number two, how do you think those two compare?
Well, Kerkorian was the polar opposite of Donald Trump in manner and personality. He was, for one thing, Kirk hated to fire people and would go a long way to avoid that. So he did. He would have been the wrong candidate for Celebrity Apprentice. But beyond that, Kirk was very mild-mannered and refused to talk about himself under any circumstance. He developed great loyalty from his people by constantly taking the risks but sharing the credit. So you can see some profound differences there with the personality and the ego of Donald Trump.
And in some ways, being a son of immigrants, does that also play not only to that narrative there, but the many stories of immigrants coming to America and becoming very successful?
Yeah, absolutely. Kirk lived the American dream. He used the American dream. He turned that American dream into just a glorious success. And he never forgot his roots and his family's roots. And when the Armenian nation was hit badly by an earthquake in the 80s, Kirk was the major beneficiary of their recovery. I mean, he's the one that, rather, the major donor to their recovery, and set up an airlift of supplies and medical equipment and such that rivaled the Berlin airlift of the 1940s. So, and he did it as a private citizen.
Again, we've been talking today with William C. Rempel. He's the author of the new book, The Gambler, How Penniless Dropout Kirk Kerkorian Became the Greatest Dealmaker in Capitalist History. Kerkorian, born in Fresno and grew up here for the first years of his life before going on to Los Angeles and a career as a multi-billion dollar investor in everything from casinos to airlines to the auto industry and film studios. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. There's a new bill in the California Capitol that would ban so-called willful defiant suspensions in California public schools. Telling us more about this, we have with us on Skype right now, reporter David Washburn. He is with the education publication EdSource. David, welcome.
Hi, Joe. Thank you.
So for people who aren't involved in education policy on a day-to-day basis, this word willful defiance has a specific meaning in California schools. Can you tell us a little more about what sorts of activities involve getting a willful defiance suspension? What are we talking about here?
Certainly. As you said, this is a very specific category of suspensions, and it's used to deal with students who purposely are disrupting a classroom environment by making actions or disrupting things for the sole purpose of just disrupting the environment rather than being angry about a specific thing or something like that. Teachers and administrators consider these to be, you know, an important classroom management tool. However, because of the relative vagueness of the term, you know, willful defiance, as opposed to specific categories like, for example, vulgarity or fighting, youth advocates have long complained that it's too subjective of a category and that they're, you know, disproportionately meted out to students of color, particularly African-American boys. And the data overwhelmingly supports that when you look at statewide suspension data and who does get suspended for willful defiance. So for years, we've had a situation where youth advocates and others have campaigned to ban this specific category of suspensions throughout, you know, through K through 12. And in 2012, they got a bill through the legislature, but Governor Brown vetoed it. Then in 2014, they reduced the ban to only include K through third grade. And that did get through. Governor Brown signed that bill into law in 2014. And that's what we've been working under ever since. And now that law, however, sunsets in July of this year. And so there is a current legislation by Senator Nancy Skinner of Oakland to extend that ban, to extend the ban, and then also expand it to K through 12. So they're making another run at that.
Do we have an idea of how big the scope of the problem is? How many suspensions are being handed out to California students under willful defiance right now?
As far as I don't know an exact number. I know that they were a significant, you know, number of suspensions, and it kind of depends on the school district. I mean, in certain places, they were used more than others. We've had a significant reduction in suspensions overall in recent years because the new California School Dashboard, which is the new accountability tool used by the state for schools, lists suspension rate as a specific category that schools are essentially graded on. So you've seen a drop in suspensions overall. And then with this ban, this K through third grade ban, you've seen a drop, you know, that has extended, and there have been, you know, just drops overall with willful defiance. And there are specific, a handful of school districts, Los Angeles Unified being one, Oakland Unified being another, where they did, as a district policy, ban these suspensions, district-wide for K through 12.
Now, there is often a conflict or tension in state government or state policy between local control and control from the top, from Sacramento. Governor Brown has made local control one of his big hallmarks of his administration with education that relates to the local control funding formula. Is this something that has popped up in the debate over this issue, whether this is, in his view, something that would take power away from local school boards?
Absolutely. And that's why we have a K through three ban right now instead of a K through 12 ban. You know, the bill made it through in 2012. Legislation made it through both the Assembly and the Senate for a full K through 12 ban. But Governor Brown vetoed it, and specifically, you know, in his veto message, made it clear that he felt that this is a local issue. This is not something that the state should be deciding, and it should not be a statewide regulation.
Do we have any idea of the relative success of those districts that have already banned this type of suspension, and also those suspensions that are now outlawed in K through third grade? Do we know how it went, how that experiment has played out? Are teachers satisfied with it? Are the concerns that critics raised, have they in any way played out?
That is a good question, and one where the answer depends on who you ask. The districts will tell you that they have, you know, done a lot to improve school climate, and, you know, that they've been able to institute other forms of discipline or alternatives to, you know, punitive discipline measures like suspensions. And so you're just, this is leading to a larger kind of sea change in how discipline and how school climate issues are dealt with. Others will tell you, specifically teachers in the trenches will say that they feel, you know, and this is not universal, but you'll definitely hear teachers who will say, you know, that I feel less control over my classroom. You've taken away an important tool, and that, you know, that the resources that we need to institute, you know, to implement some of these other alternatives have not been there. So that they feel like they're caught, you know, in a situation where they have less control over their classroom and less resources to deal with or to implement new strategies.
What are some of those alternatives if this does become law? What would districts fall back on?
That's another good question, because I think one thing, you know, one big movement in California education, and especially in dealing with discipline and school climate issues, is the idea of restorative justice, which is it's an alternative to traditional discipline in the sense that it focuses on mediation. It focuses on, you know, having circles and creating what they call harm circles, so students can meet face to face with each other over issues and with teachers and things like that. So it is, and then you have things like positive behavioral PBIS, which is positive behavioral institutional supports, I think. I might have mangled that, but it has to do with enforcing positive behavior, positive attitudes that improve the school climate, and therefore you have just a less volatile, more calm, more you know, focused school environment. And you have pockets, you know, examples where that has just worked wonderfully, and schools will tell you, and both teachers and administrators will tell you, that they've really had a real paradigm shift, you know, in this regard. Others will tell you that, you know, it's a lot of talk and not a lot of action. So it really is kind of all over the map, and we're really early on in this. So it kind of remains to be seen how some of this is going to play out.
You mentioned that teachers in the trenches, some of them at least, have some concerns about this effort to eliminate Wolfel Defiant suspensions. Where do the teachers' unions fall on this? I know that this sort of issue did come up recently in Fresno in negotiations between the union, the local union, and the school board, talking about teacher safety and school discipline practices. Is the statewide teachers' union and then local unions, are they chiming in on this?
That's interesting. Right now, the CTA, the largest union, is I think they're calling it a watch as far as this legislation that's currently under consideration. And their positions have been that they don't want to, they very much agree and are not disputing the data, which shows these suspensions are meted out disproportionately to students of color and in particular African-American boys. So they're not disputing that, but again, they're disputing the lack of resources that seem to be coming in, you know, that schools are putting in place to, you know, to take the place, so to speak, of these suspensions. So while they have not been strident in their opposition, they are definitely taking, the stance seems to be at this point that, you know, let's see what this bill might do for mandating resources or things like that before we support it. But you know, right now, kind of taking a wary, somewhat wary approach to it, I would say.
So what's next in the timeline here? We have this bill or the law that is currently on the books set to expire. You have this bill in the Senate from Senator Nancy Skinner of Berkeley. What's next?
Right now, Skinner is, if you talk to her right now, she will tell you that she is not going to back off the K through 12 ban. She thinks that this is something that needs to be done. She has just a number, almost every major youth advocacy organization in the state behind this bill. So she is, saying at this point, she's not going to back down. Meanwhile, you have Governor Brown not backing off his position at all. When it comes to his feeling that local, you know, that this should be a local issue, a local control issue. I think if I had to handicap this, that you're going to you could see perhaps a compromise along the lines of maybe they'll have a K through 6 or even a K through 8 ban, increasing it from the current K through 3. But it does remain to be seen. Somebody's going to have to back off their position. And right now, there's no indications that either side is.
It'll be an interesting policy fight in the legislature, and we'll follow that online through EdSource. David Washburn, reporter with EdSource, joining us today talking about this new effort to ban willful defiant suspensions in all K through 12 grades in California. David, thanks so much for joining us on Skype today.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and get a preview of tomorrow night's event at the Valley Public Radio Broadcast Center focused on air quality. It's the latest in our series, Be Public Live, and you're invited to attend. We'll talk about that and get a recap of the last season's pollution with our Carrie Klein coming up next. You're listening to Valley Edition. It's the second week of March, which means burning restrictions are no longer in effect throughout the San Joaquin Valley. But though the smoggy days of winter are hopefully behind us, there's still a lot to talk about. Later this week, we'll be hosting a panel event on the future of our air quality. That's Wednesday night at Valley Public Radio's Broadcast Center. Moderating that panel will be our own Carrie Klein, and she's here to give us a little preview of what we'll be talking about and to recap the last season's pollution stats. Carrie, welcome.
Hi.
So we just wrapped up the wintertime check before you burn season, as the Valley Air District calls it, and the Air District has some data out.
Mm-hmm.
What do we know so far?
So this winter was pretty bad. It wasn't horrendous. It wasn't the worst, but it was significantly worse than last year, and by some measures was the worst in many, many years. As we reported earlier this season, the time period right around Christmas and New Year's was the longest period in Bakersfield. It was the longest period of consecutive unhealthy days since 1999. That's huge. And overall, this winter had far more no-burn days than the previous winter. So if we talk about days specifically where there's no burning unless registered, as it's called, Kern County had 13 more no-burn days than last winter. Merced County had 25 more of these days. Plus, if you look at days where no burning was allowed, period, most counties never had a single one of those days last year, but this year, almost every county did. And the district also almost doubled the number of burn violations it handed out this year. So things were a lot worse.
Now, with that bad stretch of pollution we had at the end of December and the beginning of January, I know that prompted us to take a fresh look at this issue, and we produced a whole bunch of reporting on this. Kind of give us a little recap of what we've learned just since we started digging into this issue anew in late December.
Yeah, this prompted really a lot of reporting this winter, and starting with a story about that really smoggy stretch. We experienced it throughout the valley, but it was worst in the Bakersfield area. That kind of led us to look into why the Air District wasn't enforcing burn restrictions more. And we also discovered kind of a big widespread crowdsourcing campaign where people can buy these low-cost air sensors, and kind of community members are taking air monitoring into their own hands. Reported a couple stories on that. Also talked about smartphone apps where you can find air quality information. And of course, we're also looking into emerging research into some of the more sinister health impacts of air pollution.
So why was the air so bad last winter?
Well, there's not just one reason. It's a whole bunch of reasons altogether. You know, one is that we've had just a really dry winter, and rain itself doesn't necessarily clean up the air, but the low pressure and wind that usually accompany storm systems usually do altogether. The Air District will tell you that wildfires, the terrible, awful wildfires that we experienced in Northern and Southern California earlier this season, that they blew a lot of smoke into the valley, though some atmospheric scientists would disagree with that. They don't see that in the satellite imagery. But what a lot of this really does come down to is local emissions. The emissions data aren't available for this winter. They're only available as recent as 2015. But according to state data from that time period, farming operations are still the largest source of particle pollution in the valley.
So I understand you've had a chance to dig into that state data on pollution sources. Anything interesting that you found there? And I guess it goes down by county. It's not just valley-wide.
Yeah, it can go down by county. Well, so on the aggregate, I'll start at the county. I'll start at the valley level. On the aggregate, the valley's biggest source of particle pollution, or PM2.5. Like I said, it's farming operations, followed by fugitive wind-blown dust, which is kind of dust from many sources blown into the air, road dust, and on-road vehicle emissions. Not far below that is residential wood burning. People still do a lot of burning despite the Check Before You Burn program. Also, we can burn on burn days where it's allowed. If we want to talk about ozone, though, which is the valley's summertime pollutant, particularly its precursor pollutant nitrous oxides, or NOx, on-road vehicles account for more than half of all the emissions in the valley, followed by farm equipment, off-road equipment, trains, and food and agricultural processing. But we can look at that at a more specific county level as well. And that's where we get into some interesting information about specific polluters. Even though farming operations are the biggest share of PM2.5 emissions in general, the valley's biggest single emitters of particle pollution are oil and gas producers, including Chevron, Era, and Berry Petroleum Company, followed by power plants and biomass facilities. The biggest of those are in Kern County. And then when it comes to nitrous oxides, again, a precursor to ozone, we're looking instead at glass factories, things like Guardian Industries and PPG Industries in Fresno. And then we've got oil and gas producers, again, in Kern County, all of those contributing to NOx.
Now, I understand it gets really interesting when you look at some of the smaller counties because they have smaller pollution burdens or overall net pollution. But there's some interesting things in that data.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we should remember that the smaller counties, they're not the biggest polluters overall. So their biggest polluters in their counties are still maybe not as significant as these really big ones that we were just talking about. But let's take a look at Kings County. And so, for instance, you don't see these giant energy operations, giant industrial manufacturers the way you do in other counties. So there, the biggest polluter is Naval Air Station Lemoore, which kicks up lots of dust. And, you know, it presumably manages its own power supply. So it has emissions associated with those. And then still among the top five polluters of both nitrous oxides and particulate matter is also Avenal State Prison. And then if we take another county, Merced, just as an example, also not a big polluter, their biggest source of particulate matter is poultry, Foster Farms. And when it comes to NOx, one of their biggest polluters is Sensient, a company that creates food ingredients, some of which are organic and non-GMO.
So a lot of interesting data there, and that's, again, historical data going back to 2015. Before mm-hmm. we go on to what we're going to talk about tomorrow night at the station, and again, if you're just joining us, we're hosting a special community forum in person. It's part of our Be Public Live, a series of community events at Valley Public Radio tomorrow night at our broadcast center in Clovis. Before we get to that, I want to go back to the residential wood burning. Mm-hmm. How many people actually got fines last year, or citations, I should say? Is it a significant number? I mean, are we talking thousands of people or a dozen?
It's well, it's between. It's around 470 or 480 people got fines last year. And so that is, it's a lot bigger than the previous year, which had been about 270. However, it does still seem pretty small compared to the size of the valley, the size of the jurisdictions there for the Valley Air District, and the number of residents here, and presumably the number of residents that use wood burning stoves and fireplaces.
And again, those are data that just came out from the Valley Air District. Mm-hmm. So moving on to this event Wednesday night, we're kicking off this new series we started last year called Be Public Live Community Forums. This year, because it's the station's 40th anniversary, all of our Be Public Live events will be focused on the future, the next 40 years of a particular issue. We're going to do one on the arts coming up later this summer, but this one is about air quality, mm-hmm. and we're looking specifically at where air quality is going and how can we clean up the air here in the valley.
That's right. Yep. This one is titled The Future of Our Air Quality. It's meant to be really forward-looking and not just in time, but also to really scope out beyond just looking, you know, myopically here at the valley. So we think of the air quality as being a really local issue, and of course the impacts are very local, but there are a lot of forces acting outside the valley that have a really big impact here, and that will be changing in coming decades. And so that includes things like climate and greenhouse gas regulations coming out of Sacramento, coming out of the governor's office. The cap and trade program was just renewed last year. Governor Brown has called for a tremendous number of electric vehicles to be on the roads by 2030. All of these things are going to impact emissions and air quality. So we'll be talking about all those factors, and we will zoom back into the valley to talk about what's changing locally in terms of pollution sources and climate, things like that, and to discuss the Air District's, you know, latest strategy to meet the EPA's air pollution standards.
Yeah, and we'll be continuing to cover these events in our own editorial coverage here on the station and look into a lot of these issues, but it's going to be interesting to hear our panelists. Who are they?
So our panelists are three individuals with big stakes in air quality issues here locally. There is Tulare County Supervisor Stephen Worthley. He's the vice chair of our local air district's governing board. There's also Dolores Barajas-Weller, who's the director of the Central Valley Air Quality Coalition, and Tom Knox, executive director of Valley Clean Air Now. All of these folks are working in their own way to reduce air pollution and its impacts here in the valley. So it should be a really exciting discussion.
And again, if you're hoping to attend, seating is limited. We are going to be broadcasting this on our website, kvpr.org, and you'll hear excerpts on the air, I'm sure, at a later date. With seating limited, though, we do ask that people RSVP before you go to the event because we don't want to have people turned away at the door.
That's right,
with the fire marshal or anything like that. So you can find the link on our website at kvpr.org to email your RSVP and get more information. Again, it's tomorrow night. We hope to have you here at our broadcast center in Clovis. Again, Carrie Klein, thanks so much, and we're looking forward to the event tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you. Me too.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Last week, news broke that California's high-speed rail project is facing another setback. The plan to connect L.A. and San Francisco with a bullet train running through the Central Valley will now cost over $77 billion. On top of that, Phase 1 of the project will not be fully operational until the year 2033. That's 25 years after California voters approved spending bond funds on the rail line. Here to tell us more about what's in the plan is the Fresno Bee's Tim Sheehan, who's been one of the leaders in covering this issue statewide for a number of years. Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. How are you this morning?
Doing very well. Well, look at this plan here. So several things have changed. Let's start with cost. Where is the cost estimate, the increased in cost estimate built into this project? Where is it coming from?
Well, it's coming from several different factors. You've got inflation just because of the basic extension of the time frame. And then you've got things that are just costing more than were anticipated 2, 4, or 6 years ago. The $64 billion estimate that they've been using up until this new business plan emerged back in 2012. So that ballpark figure has been floating around for the last 6 years. And so I think this is sort of a reality check for both the authority and for people who support high-speed rail, and sort of a confirmation for those who have been skeptics of the program. You've got that. You've got things costing more. You've got the costs associated with delays in litigation. And I think they're learning from some very hard experiences that they've seen here in the Valley with these first construction segments.
And, of course, that's the estimate of the overall project cost. That's not how much money they have set aside. Given that the state funds, the federal funds, and the cap and trade funds that are already anticipated or spoken for, what's the gap on this project? How much is still out there to be appropriated for this?
Well, if we talk about what they want to do in terms of the first operating segment they want to do, the San Joaquin Valley to Silicon Valley segment that has been described as their first operating segment, they are, depending on the estimate, somewhere between $8 and $13 billion short of that. And then if you extend that to phase one, the whole San Francisco to Los Angeles stretch, then you're probably talking somewhere about the $30 to $40 billion range of which they're short, just because of the amount of track that still needs to be done and the technical nature of getting through, say, the Pacheco Pass, tunneling through that or tunneling through the San Gabriel Mountains down south.
Yeah. Did they just realize now that it would be difficult to tunnel through some of those segments? Why is this now an issue technically?
I think they've always known that it was going to be challenging. They decided to go north instead of south back in the 2014 business plan. I think these things go through so many iterations. But when they decided to go north to San Jose rather than south to Los Angeles, part of the belief was that it would be less technically challenging to get through the Pacheco Pass Mountains, through the Coast Range, than through the San Gabriels and the Tehachapi Mountains. But even so, you're still crossing a fault zone. I think they always thought it was going to be a challenge. I think when they started fine-tuning the cost estimates and how much it's costing to tunnel, I think that's more where the unexpected challenges came in.
So there's also timeline changes, as we've alluded to, and mm-hmm. also not so much route changes, but endpoint changes.
Right.
And those have gone through various iterations over the years and over the different business plans. Walk us through what changed timeline-wise, both for L.A. to San Francisco operations and then operations in the Valley.
Well, in terms of the timeline changes, they were thinking initially, as recently as 4 and 2 years ago, about starting the operations on the valley-to-valley, Silicon Valley to San Joaquin Valley segment, hoping to get those going by 2025, 2027, and starting L.A. to San Francisco service by 2029. Now we're seeing that whole phase one being pushed out to 2033, excuse me, and probably 2027 to 2029 for the initial operating segment, valley to valley rides.
In terms of
extending the lines, the endpoints of this valley segment into Bakersfield instead of from north to Bakersfield, and from San Jose into San Francisco, that's also a quasi new proposal.
Is this a case of moving the goalposts once the game has already started?
I think so. And that's something that we've seen, a lot with this project. Initially we saw that initially when this was pitched with Prop 1A in 2008, the initial idea was somewhere in the vicinity of $33 to $40 billion for the entire San Francisco, Sacramento, L.A., San Diego project. And then in about 2010 or 2012, we saw that shrink back to a phase one operating system, San Francisco to LA. Then we saw it stretch back to an initial operating segment of first the San Joaquin Valley to the San Fernando Valley, and then the switch in 2014 from the San Joaquin Valley to the Silicon Valley. So this has been an ever-changing process as different challenges and different solutions, for lack of a better word, have popped up and been floated in these various business plans.
High-Speed Rail Authority has a new CEO, Brian Kelly. He comes to the agency from the California Transportation Agency. Mm-hmm. Does this plan have his imprint? What sort of a mark is he making on the authority, and what is emerging as his strategy, I guess you could say?
Well, I think it's hard to tell how much of it is his influence and how much of it is an evolution of attitudes with the high-speed rail authorities, infrastructure and its board. But I think we're seeing a more realistic assessment in this particular business plan than we've seen in 2016, 2014, or 2012. I think there's just a realism and more acknowledgement that the challenges that we're facing here in the San Joaquin Valley with high-speed rail in terms of schedule, in terms of cost, in terms of right-of-way acquisition, are having a bigger impact than had been acknowledged previously.
Certainly this is an engineering challenge, a construction challenge. It's also a political challenge. Is that, certainly that's on the radar of the High Speed Rail Authority, but the issue of connecting to Southern California, the state's population center, is that something that weighs on the authority, do you think, in just trying to maintain some degree of public and politician support for this project, especially if, again, in the last two business plans, we've seen more of an emphasis of getting this connectivity to the Bay Area from the Central Valley? Are Los Angeles area voters potentially a problem for the High-Speed Rail Authority?
I think L.A.'s been a problem politically and publicly. I think that's been a problem for the last few years because you've got pockets of population that don't want this thing coming through their areas, particularly in the San Gabriel Mountains. But yes, I think the fact that they've focused so much, the about-face that they made a few years ago to go north instead of south, I think left a bad taste in the mouths of some politicians down there, the assembly members and senators who do effectively hold the purse strings for this. And so I think there's quite an emphasis in this business plan on, look, we're not abandoning you. We're continuing to invest in these major pieces that will get ready for high-speed rail. But whether that's going to maintain the political will or keep it intact is a big question mark, I think. And I think they are definitely aware of it at the authority.
Again, we're talking about the latest edition of the High-Speed Rail Business Plan, a draft document released last week that now puts the cost of the project from L.A. to San Francisco through the Central Valley at over $77 billion, and a project that won't be fully operational on that stretch until 2033, 25 years after California voters approved spending bond funds on the rail line back in 2008. You can continue to read Tim Sheehan's fine coverage on this issue at the Fresno Bee and fresnobee.com. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure.
As always. And again, as always, we thank you for joining us here on Valley Edition. That's it for today's program. You can send us your thoughts. Our email address is talk@kvpr.org. You can also send us a tweet. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. Subscribe to our podcast as well. You can find that on your favorite podcast app through the iTunes Store, through Google Play, and on our website at kvpr.org. And find all of our local stories there and on our app. Again, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring the Community Water Center's leaders as recipients of the 2018 James Irvine Foundation's Leadership Awards, on the web at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.